Hey, All Sides listeners, I'm Steve Brown, the co-host of WOSU's new political podcast, Snollygoster. Every week, we'll talk to newsmakers, reporters, and lots of other smart people to get the latest on politics from around Columbus and the rest of the state. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Facebook is facing more scrutiny over how it handles user data. The Delete Facebook hashtag is trending and calls for federal legislation continue on Capitol Hill. To make matters worse, last week a leaked memo written by a Facebook executive and published by BuzzFeed News came off as particularly tone-deaf in light of recent scandals. The memo claimed that Facebook's positive influence of connecting the world outweighs any harm it might cause. Senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed News, Alex Kantrowitz, has been covering the memo's release and its fallout. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me in.
The memo, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a two-year-old memo, right?
Yeah, it was published on June 18th, 2016.
So why its re-release and why the fallout now?
I think it's a pretty important memo that will, you know, no matter when it was written, takes you into the mindset of what Facebook has been aiming towards for a long time. So whether it was written in 2016 or yesterday, it does show people exactly how Facebook has, been approaching the really complicated issues that it's been dealing with and definitely being rigged over the coals for over the past few months. Basically, the memo says, connecting people is a de facto good, whether the costs whether there are positive things or negative things that come out of it. The company needs to focus on growth. And seeing that written in 2016, now we know now all the problems that have sort of come out of that mentality.
How has Facebook responded to the re-release of the memo, to the renewed scrutiny of this memo by Facebook Vice President Andrew Bosworth?
That's a good question. Yep. So first of all, Mark Zuckerberg has disavowed the memo. He's basically said, it's more than just connecting people. It's about bringing people closer together. And you can see that Facebook has taken concrete steps to shift its mission since the release of the memo, because it changed its mission from, make the world more open, connected, to bring people closer together last year. And Zuckerberg referenced that in a statement given to us. Bosworth, for his part, said that he had released the memo in part to just show that this is an argument. And he never really believed it, and he showed that this is an argument inside Facebook, and he wanted people to see, maybe what he believed to be an extreme position, and then have it be broken down internally by debate. Because, if we could take a step back here, Facebook has like a pretty unique culture. The company, their employees will post employee-only posts, and basically, like, people would hash out issues in pertaining to politics or sports or parenting or whatever it may be, with the rest of their Facebook friends in public. Facebook hashes out issues regarding how the company should act and respond to crises and, approach policy in a much similar way in Facebook-only internal posts. And that's what this was. So for Bosworth, he came out after the fact and said, this was his opportunity to put some ideas out that he knew weren't going to be popular inside the company, and have them sort of, beaten down in the court of public opinion inside Facebook. Hopefully the company emerged better because of it. So that's his position on the whole situation.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Facebook memo. It was written in 2016. It's being reviewed again. BuzzFeed published the memo again by Facebook Vice President Andrew Bosworth. He has it wrote about how it matters, growth matters more than anything else at the company. My guest is Alex Kantrowitz. He's a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. A U.S. senator has already called for congressional action over this memo. What sort of action?
That is the million or $400 billion question, and I don't know exactly what they're going to do, Congress. Remember, this is the renewed calls for Facebook to come in and testify are due to a data leak that happened in 2014, and afterwards, Facebook has put in place, even before this came to light, they put in place much more stringent data policies, and they've put even more stringent data policies in after the revelations. So what's Congress going to do? I don't know. I mean, if Congress didn't act after Facebook was found to have been exploited by foreign actors seeking to manipulate the U.S. election, we're talking about our democracy right here. Is Congress going to act based off of a data leak in 2014? I find it doubtful, actually. I think that there's, we'll probably see Zuckerberg testify, but whether there's going to be actual legislation that's going to come out of this, I wouldn't hold my breath for it.
Senator Markey has said that they want to use the Honest Ads Act on Facebook. What is that?
So the Honest Ads Act would require some additional disclosure on political ads. So, when you watch a political ad on TV, you always hear the politician responsible for it say something like, "I'm Joe Biden and I endorse this message," because there are laws in place that Congress felt was put in place because they felt it was important for Americans to know who's paying for the ads that they're being shown. Okay, well, those laws don't exist on the internet in the same way they do on TV. And what happens is you have this ecosystem where there are ads running all over the place. We have no idea who's behind them. In fact, because of the lack of these laws, we had, criminal-linked troll agencies running ads, and we didn't know who was paying for them. So the Honest Ads Act is an attempt inside Congress to require a similar disclosure act, disclosure on online political ads like we have on TV. That's the basic way to look at it. Fortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, you don't want to put a value judgment on it, but that act is stalled in Congress right now. So it hasn't gone anywhere, and it's been in the Senate and the House for months.
Let's go back to Andrew Bosworth for a minute. He has been a polarizing figure inside Facebook for years, right? Who tell us about him and what his role there is.
Yeah, some people that we spoke with said this was just Bos being Bos. So Bosworth, he's an interesting character. He is he's one of Facebook's earlier employees. If you look at his Twitter bio, his Facebook bio, he'll say he's one of the inventors of the newsfeed and Facebook groups. And he's a bit of a firebrand inside the company. He's like pretty provocative, and you can see some of that come out on Twitter as well, where he likes to go back and forth with reporters about the way they're covering the company and the way they're viewing issues, including myself. So he's a unique character, and whether that's good or bad for Facebook, I'm not sure. But I do think that there are companies that benefit from people, like this, who will push the edge and then get pushed back and help companies, as opposed to skirt around some of the tough questions they face, actually deal with them head on.
And you think he does deal with these things head on?
I think that the guy is definitely not subtle, I'll put it that way.
Well, he seems like more of a distraction than anything else to me. That's why I was asking. He's the guy waving his arms over next to, somewhere in the other direction.
That's one way to look at the way he operates. Honestly, he's polarizing inside Facebook, that's for sure. Hmm. And I don't know. I mean, it's hard to really say without the full context of viewing everything that this guy does inside the company.
Right.
But, look, he was presiding over, I'm not saying he's not without fault. I mean, he was presiding over Facebook's ad operation, ad platform for years, including during the, in the run-up to the 2016 campaign. And, a lot of this, Facebook's now saying it wants to be the most transparent ad platform, in the world. But where was this beforehand? Mm-hmm. Why wasn't that something that was de facto built into the platform? I don't know. I mean, it's obviously a lapse in their judgment. And they're paying for it now.
Your expectations for any real changing coming from this Cambridge Analytica scandal, do you think Facebook's really going to change its practices or just shift them? I don't know. What do you think?
So I wrote a couple of stories about this. One of the stories I asked, is Facebook just going to redo the facade or build from the ground up? And I am I'm convinced now that they're just going to try to redo the facade. I don't think they're going to do a full rebuild unless they're forced to. And now I also wrote another story saying nothing's going to happen to Facebook or Mark Zuckerberg. Now with a couple of weeks, of seeing what's happened after I wrote that story, I think it's possible to kind of go back and, you know, say I was right about a few points and I was wrong about one.
Like what?
So again, I don't think Facebook is going to change unless people force them to, people from the outside force them to. So advertisers certainly, so there are four main constituencies, and we can just go through them if we have time. Advertisers are one of those constituencies. We've seen advertisers talk with their ad dollars. They've been able to force change by pulling ads and using their voice that way. That's not going to happen here. If anything, advertisers have seen this focus on how effective the Facebook ad platform is as a case study. And you even had something like Clorox coming out yesterday and saying they stand with Facebook. Never seen an advertiser come out and say they stand with an embattled company accused of being cavalier about privacy rights. So I don't think advertisers are going to take a stand. Congress, we went over already. They, you know, don't seem to have much in terms of new legislation coming through. I asked, you know, Senator Markey, who you mentioned, said Facebook, you know, is going to have to, Congress must act if Facebook can't protect the integrity of his platform and user safety. But he didn't introduce any new ads. He has any new acts in order to, you know, rein the company in. He is a co-sponsor of the Honest Ads Act, which we said is, sort of stalled at this point. So Congress, I'm going to say, nope, they're not going to force Facebook to do anything. Then you have users. You know, you mentioned at the top, there's this delete Facebook movement where people are saying they're going to delete Facebook. It's not really happening. Facebook has actually risen in the ad store last time I checked, which shows that downloads are, you know, steady, if not increasing. And a lot of people say, oh, we're leaving Facebook, we're going to Instagram. I hate to break the news to the people that are going to Instagram to flee Facebook. Facebook owns Instagram, so you're not really leaving Facebook that way. The final stakeholder, and this is where I think I might have been wrong, is Wall Street. Wall Street analysts have sent notes out to their clients saying, this is a great buying opportunity. You're getting Facebook cheap if you buy now.
Because the stock has dipped, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that that was a sign that Wall Street isn't going to punish Facebook either. But one of the amazing things that we're witnessing right now is the investors aren't taking the analyst's word for it. And Facebook has dropped about $100 billion in market cap. Now, look, it's still a pretty healthy company in terms of its financials. It's, you know, again, advertisers are going to continue to spend with it. And it's still worth over $400 billion. That's a significant and hefty hit that's got to get, you know, at least some institutional investors and the board thinking, you know, what's going wrong. And if it continues to sink, then we might end up seeing that rebuild of the foundation as opposed to redoing of the facade. So that's the thing I would keep an eye on is, well, how does Wall Street continue to respond to this? Because when you lose $100 billion in market cap, you can't just brush that off. That's a significant situation right there. And it's going to get people thinking and questioning.
I'm trying to figure out why the dip why the devaluation or the revaluation of it. Because you said that the advertisers are sticking up for Facebook, and really the number of people that are into that, you know, whatever the hashtag movement is to drop Facebook is inconsequential. So where would the financial risk be at this point?
You know, I'm trying to figure that one out too, honestly, because again, they're going against the advice of their own analysts. I think there is such a thing as financial panic. I mean, we do know that the market doesn't operate exactly rationally all the time, despite what some economists might want to believe. So, you know, you're seeing, I think what you're seeing is retail investors, you know, are reading the headlines and pulling their money out of the stock.
Well, there's also speculation that it was overvalued to begin with, and it's just a big correction.
Yeah, I think that's one possibility. Certainly, they have excellent multiples. If you're an investor, and it's possible that the market is saying, "Hey, wait a second, maybe we put too much money into this company." But look, if you look at the future of this company's business, Facebook is an advertising business. Advertising dollars are moving online. Facebook and Google are capturing something like 90% of every additional ad dollar spent online. So there are billions and billions of dollars left to continue to move from television into digital. And those ad dollars will, in the long term, make that move. So, that's the end of the day when you're assessing Facebook's value. That's what you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. So the question is, like, I don't know. A lot of the value was based off of that very basic fundamental belief. And I don't think there's much to change that belief. So, you know, again, like, whether it was overvalued or not, I would say more investor panic right now versus a fundamental problem with Facebook's valuation. But time will tell. You know, I've expected it to bounce up. I've looked at the chart every day since this crisis started, and I've expected it to bounce up, but it continues to sink. Mm-hmm. So there's something there.
Alex Kantorowicz, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Alex Kantorowicz is a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed News. We'll put some examples of his coverage of this Facebook decline and what's going on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Almost everyone has heard of Alan Turing, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, whose names are synonymous with the development of the computer age. Female innovators are less familiar, but nonetheless important. Tech journalist Claire Evans has written about those women in her new book titled Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Claire Evans.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. So why did you feel the need to write this book?
Well, the world needed it, I believe. I mean, we are all surrounded by these myths. You mentioned them in the opening. These famous male programmers and engineers and entrepreneurs that dominate our understanding of what tech is all about. But the history of this stuff is full of incredible female pioneers. And so, looking myself as a woman for some kind of precedent from which to draw, some kind of lineage which I could participate in, I couldn't find really the document that would make me feel like technology was my kingdom as well as it was anybody else's. So I felt I had to do it.
How did you track down these stories?
Well, some of the older histories a little bit familiar. I mean, there are characters like Ada Lovelace and Grace Hopper, these early computer programmers that have kind of been trotted out as symbolic figureheads of women in tech. But the later history, the stuff in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, that was just a lot of detective work, frankly. Reading other histories and looking for the one female name in the footnote and finding that person and calling her up and asking her what her story is, following that chain until I found something a little bit closer to the truth.
I thought probably one of the most fascinating parts of Hidden Figures, the now famous movie, of course, was the role that one of those figures played in making the IBM computer work for NASA. It kind of made you stamp your foot and go, what? How could we not know this?
Yeah, well, I mean, the job of tending to a computer in that way was not seen as being something important for a really long time. It's important to remember that in the early history of computing, the distinction between hardware and software wasn't really made. I mean, software was just the manipulation of hardware. It was patching cables, flipping switches, you know, putting punch cards in the roll. And those things were kind of secretarial. They weren't perceived as having their own value. And it didn't, you know, it took several decades for the development of software, which was pioneered largely by women like that, to be understood as an art form, as a language, as something with the power to transform the world.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is Tech Tuesday today. My guest is Claire Evans. She's a tech journalist. She's written about the female pioneers who were instrumental in creating the connected digital age. Her new book is titled Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. One of the earliest visionaries in computing was Ada Lovelace. She lived in the 19th century. Another one, Grace Hopper, a mathematician and U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, was another. Claire Evans, you kind of glossed over Ada Lovelace and Grace Hopper. Who was Ada Lovelace and why was she important?
Ada Lovelace is a super interesting character. She's often credited as being the person who wrote the first computer program, which is true, but she did that before the computer was even invented. So she was the daughter of the poet Lord Byron, an incredibly mathematically inclined person. Because of the time that she lived in, the Victorian age, she wasn't afforded the benefit of a university education, but she tutored herself, and she ended up making contact with Charles Babbage, who was a scientist of some repute at the time, who had designed these computing engines, which were, I mean, engine is really the right word. They were these big kind of steampunky-looking machines with gears and cogs, and they were designed to calculate polynomial tables. But she saw the beauty of them, and she understood implicitly what they were meant to do, and she devoted much of her life to writing mathematical proofs for these machines, proofs which would essentially, they were what computer programs would become. So she was the first computer programmer in history, a good century before the invention of the computer as we know it today.
So Alan Turing was reading her work?
I would hope so, yeah.
Yeah. Another pioneer, Grace Hopper, a mathematician and U.S. Navy Rear Admiral. What was her role?
She was a mathematician. She was the 11th woman to graduate from Yale with a PhD in mathematics. And she enlisted in the Navy in World War II because she wanted to participate in the war effort, thinking that she would be, you know, a cryptographer or something. But she found herself in the basement of a physics lab at Harvard and spent the entire war programming a machine called the Mark I, which was actually quite influenced by the design of Charles Babbage's engine. It was this crazy, huge machine, again, with gears and cogs and long rolls of punch tape that had to be fed by hand, the first of its kind. And she had no manual from which to draw. She had no precedent at all. I mean, it was the first machine of its kind, and it needed to be used to calculate ballistics trajectories for the war. And she took her mathematics know-how and good horse sense and basically, you know, figured it out, reverse engineered it and looked at engineering diagrams and figured out how to write programs for this thing. And she ended up running this very important computing system throughout World War II and then after the war, becoming a major pioneer in the design of automatic programming, which is to say the design of programming as we know it today.
Right. Was she hard to find, or is the Navy pretty proud of her and puts her out there?
Oh, the Navy's real proud of her. She's really one of the most famous figures in the history of women in computing. In her later years, you know, the Navy, she stayed in the Navy. She became a Rear Admiral. She was appointed Commodore before she retired. And she was very, very much the public face of computing for the Navy for a long time. So she's one of those really sort of famous heroes, one of those kind of sticker book heroes of women in tech. But she's a really interesting character and much more complex, I think, than much of the history, often reveals.
A woman played a big role in the development of hypertext on the web. It was Wendy Hall. First, tell us what we mean by hypertext and what role she played.
Yeah, hypertext is one of those things, you know, we think we know what it means, but it's basically the idea of linking ideas together through links. So the web is built on hypertext. We code web pages in hypertext markup language. It's this idea of creating links. So it's very fundamental to our use of computers as knowledge systems today. But the web just popularized hypertext. Before the web came out, there was a good decade of research being done in computer science research at companies like Apple and Sun Microsystems that was pioneered mostly by women. It was very open to female researchers for whatever reason, probably because it was a little bit less challenging to break into than classical programming, which is more kind of rule-oriented and engineer-dominated. Hypertext is one of those fields that it's interesting to people in the social sciences. It's interesting to people who are interested in the way we learn. So it was really kind of expansive, and a great deal of women worked in it. Dame Wendy Hall, who was a British computer scientist, did incredible work in hypertext before the web. And she, in fact, invented a system which solved a lot of the problems that the web still has today. So one of the biggest problems on the web is this idea of a 404 error. When you click on a link and you get there and there's nothing there, it's broken. That's because hypertext on the web goes only in one direction. So if the page that you're linking to goes away for whatever reason, then that information is lost. Wendy Hall's system designed it so that the hypertext, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here.
No, I'm interested because I get those 404 errors. Yeah.
But hypertext, in her system and in many systems of her era, went in two directions. So the information would be retained even if one of the pages, for whatever reason, was taken down or lost. Because people understood in those days that the value of a link is not so much in each individual node, but in the information connecting both. I mean, what we know about what brings ideas together is as valuable a piece of information as the individual ideas. So all these older hypertext systems were designed with that in mind. And Wendy's system had no such thing as 404 errors. So if we had, I think about this a lot, if we had just taken a slightly different path, if we had popularized a slightly different system, if history had, had shaken out slightly differently, we might have a much better and more equitable web.
What about Elizabeth, is it Feinler or Feinler from West Virginia? She was a librarian, which makes complete sense. You know, she wanted to curate. She wanted to organize all this garbage out there.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think there are a lot of women in this history who are in roles like this, like secretarial type roles or information science roles, librarian type roles. And historically, those aren't privileged in the same way that, you know, hard computer science and engineering people and the sort of more technical side has been privileged. But yeah, you know, we live in an information age, and the way that we manage information and interface with it is as important, if not more, than the infrastructure that underlies those connections. So people like Jake Feinler, who was essentially a librarian or an information scientist, whose role I will explain momentarily, you know, they've been ignored for a super long time, but I think their contributions are as important. So Jake was a librarian for the internet, basically. So in the very earliest version of the internet, the ARPANET, it was designed for computer scientists and researchers to access resources remotely. And the only way that they could know which resources they could access at different host sites throughout the early network was by calling a central office called the Network Information Center at Stanford. And the Network Information Center was the home for all information about the internet. So technical documentation, registration for if you wanted to add a new host site, information about who manned every single station and what kind of resources were available there. And it was quite literally a phone number for the internet, and it was answered by this woman, Feinler, and her staff, which is completely insane to think about. I mean, she was the one-woman Google of her day. She was the only person who knew where everything on the internet was for close to 20 years. And the fact that, you know, she's been a footnote up until now is just really quite boggling to me.
You call her Jake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was her nickname.
Her nickname.
Jake Feinler.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Stacey Horn, another notable, ran an early social network in the 80s. I guess this is Facebook-esque, but different. How so?
Much better, I would agree. I mean, Stacey started one of the earliest social networks in history in 1989. And she ran it out of her apartment in New York for most of its tenure. And it was, you know, by the standards of today, obviously quite elemental. It was text-based only, you know, no images at all. You would be talking to other people in this kind of message board format. But it had instant messaging, and it had email built into it as well. The amazing thing about her network, Echo, was that at a time when the entire internet population was only about 10% female, Echo was about 50-50 male and female because she was the only system administrator who was trying. She went out and she recruited women on the street. She asked women about their experiences online. She made membership free for women. She built private groups for women so that they could talk to each other on the service. But the most important thing she did was that she made sure that all the administrators and moderators on her service were equally male and female. So if you went to a certain conversation, it would be always moderated by a man and a woman. That way, when women joined the service, they would see themselves reflected in the power structure. They would see themselves as, you know, part of the dynamic conversation that was going on, and they wouldn't lurk. They would participate. So Echo was this very unusual, very sort of early space that was hospitable for women on the internet. And it still exists today. It never made the leap to the web. It's still a text-based bulletin board system that you can dial into if you have the compulsion.
Hmm. Why didn't it make the leap?
At the time, she couldn't afford it. And it was kind of a risky proposition. I mean, when the web came about, it was a revolutionary thing, of course, but it came about at a time when people had already been connecting with one another through things like commercial online services and bulletin board systems for decades. And a lot of those systems had sustainable business models. They had people who were paying members who would pay monthly fees to connect to a service. And the web was exciting, but it was, you know, free. We still struggle with this today. We don't really understand how best to make money online. And often we find ourselves in situations like the Facebook situation where the only way that the service can make money is by exploiting its user base, right? Mm-hmm. By selling our information to advertisers and nefarious other sources. So, it didn't seem like a good idea at the time for a lot of people to make the jump to the web. And for what it's worth, I mean, Echo has survived for decades and decades because it never made that jump. It stayed in this very sort of skeletal tier of the infrastructure of social media. And in that way, it's become kind of a time capsule, quite fascinating for people like me.
Given her attention to gender balance, was Stacey Horn part of that cyber feminism movement in the 90s that you wrote about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the cyber feminists were a kind of arts and culture oriented movement that exploded around the development of the World Wide Web. I think a lot of women saw networked technology as something that was kind of naturally feminine or something. And this is something I don't necessarily think has aged well, but they saw the nature of connection as being a female thing, that feminist work is about community building and connection and networking. And they saw networks and they thought, well, this is perfect for feminists. The internet is perfect for feminists. It's the medium we've all been waiting for. And many people participated in that movement. I think Stacey, I don't think she was, you know, a card-carrying cyber feminist, but I would certainly say that she was part of that generation of women reckoning with what these new possibilities of networked culture could bring us.
Were there stories that you couldn't include in the book? Is there more?
Oh, there's so much more. That's the thing that's the most maddening about this for me, is that we have been submitted to so many of these stories about men founding companies in their garages over and over again. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a wealth of material of equally interesting, fascinating, and instructive stories throughout the history involving women. And I can't tell you how much more there is. I mean, I was heartbroken at the amount of stuff I had to cut. I hope perhaps one day I can do a sequel mm-hmm. to even begin to chip away at the vast material there is there. But if you ever have any doubt about women's place in computing history, let me tell you, it is very much our domain and always has been.
Claire Evans, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Claire Evans is a tech journalist. She's written about the female pioneers who were instrumental in creating the digital age as we know it. Her new book is titled Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple's new tablet, the iPad 2018, adds many new features from the higher-end iPad Pro, but it manages to keep the price, well, I guess it depends on your perspective, reasonable. It's part of an effort to get more iPads into the hands of kids in classrooms where less expensive Google Chromebooks have staked a claim. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
One of the big improvements in this new version of the iPad is that it can work with the Apple Pencil. Tell us more about how that works.
So the Apple Pencil was originally designed for the iPad Pro line, the more expensive Pro line of iPads that was designed to allow for a special level of drawing on the iPad itself. It was great for artists who wanted this kind of portable way of contributing to their art. And the iPad Pro is designed with this kind of zero gap construction between the glass and the actual display, so that it was as close to as possible feeling like you were drawing on a piece of paper. It's something that a lot of tech companies have been working on over the last couple of years, is taking this tablet concept, you know, with a stylus or a pen or however the tech that each company is using is implementing it, but really making it feel as close to naturally writing as possible. And that was what Apple accomplished with the iPad Pro.
And they decided it was worth it and affordable enough to put into the 2018.
So the 2018 is actually very, very similar to the 2017 in that the display tech is not quite the same kind of display tech that's in the iPad Pro line. This is a continuation of the kind of the basic starter version of the iPad that now also supports this pencil. Apple decided that the decision here was all about letting kids use the pencil tech in classrooms, because the price difference between a standard iPad and an iPad Pro can be up to, you know, $200 to $300, which is just too much for an individual classroom to bear when it comes to multiple tablets for kids in a classroom. So this kind of removes that barrier to entry and gives kids the access to this pen input for not just coloring, but also handwriting practice and things like that in a all digital format.
What a concept, using digital format to teach handwriting, finally.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the display tech is in, you know, a accurate enough way that information can be translated to the paper mm-hmm. with the same level of accuracy, then it seems generally worth it, especially in an environment where you've got, 20 and 30 kids in a classroom that are all, each consuming multiple pieces of paper each day practicing.
What didn't the new iPad take from the iPad Pro?
It didn't take the display, and it also didn't take the display sizes. This is what we're seeing with what is actually the sixth generation of the original iPad is actually the same kind of display size, so that 9.7 inch screen as opposed to the 10.3 or the 12.5 inch versions. So this is, if you have used the kind of the full size iPad before, then it's still that same size. It's not the two bigger versions that made it into the Pro size.
What about now, when Apple announced the new tablet, they focused on using it in classrooms. They're trying to compete with the Google Chrome, right? What's going on?
Well, so classrooms all across the United States have really shifted from Windows PCs or Macs before it to Chromebooks, because they are incredibly inexpensive. They can be very easily maintained by teachers and basic service faculty for the school districts. It's just a very simple, inexpensive thing to set up and deploy, and it doesn't require a whole lot of work on behalf of the teacher to maintain in a classroom. It's difficult for a student to become easily distracted by an app on a Chromebook when you can set them up to be very, very minimalist and not have a lot going on them. iPads, while they are, they can be set up very similarly, they lack, a full size keyboard. They lack, a lot of the kind of basic laptop style designs that are useful for typing classes and research projects and things like that. And maintaining that kind of traditional mouse input that the general assumption is that a lot of kids are going to have at home. Apple has been kind of pushing against that and saying that, the phone is kind of the primary computer for a lot of parents in the home anyway. So there's a good chance that tablets and phones are actually what, kids in these kind of developing ages are used to at home. So there really isn't a huge push for, having something that has a physically attached keyboard or something like that, that these are accessories that can be added to create an experience the kids are already familiar with.
It does seem like the classroom is the logical next frontier. Now that you're right, they've adapted them, they've embraced them. They're all across the country. What's at stake here as far as a market goes?
Well, really, this is a massive thing. You know, when kids are raised in a particular operating system, that's the thing that they tend to gravitate towards when they go to buy their own computers. You know, mm-hmm. So I went through almost the entirety of my school career on Macs, and when I went to buy a machine for my first college computer, a MacBook seemed like a logical, change. Whereas my brothers, both all of their schooling happened on Windows PCs, and so when they went to college, they very much wanted to stay in that Windows experience. So it's not difficult to imagine a situation in which kids have had the Google ecosystem and the Chrome setup throughout their entire educational career to get to a point and want to buy, you know, a higher end Chromebook as their machine for use in school, and that eliminates Apple and Microsoft from that equation entirely. And there's no real space for Microsoft apps when you've been raised in this entire ecosystem. And Apple is an ecosystem unto itself. So Apple wants to work with schools to make the iPad, you know, the primary computer that these kids experience, so that when they move to having their own computer, the Apple ecosystem is something that they consider as an option.
As a parent with kids in school yourself, I mean, what kind of considerations do you think school districts should be giving to these purchases in the future?
I think that you know, price and compatibility are really what it comes down to. If you know, the price per device is definitely something that every school is going to consider, and it's difficult when you look at the price of an iPad at, you know, $329 for just the tablet, you know, and not considering the keyboard that a lot of classrooms are going to need attached to it at some point to you know, continue that experience, or the pencils. You know, the Apple Pencil is also a separate purchase that would go for some of these educational purposes. But the Apple ecosystem lends itself very well to environments where developers are building tons of education-focused apps and services that tie into a lot of parenting tools. There are just a ton of apps that have, you know, email this thing to the parents once a week to give them progress reports and things like that, which are valuable to teachers. Mm-hmm. And there aren't as many of those experiences right now on Chrome OS. There's a lot of kind of web-based things that just don't work quite as well from teachers that I've spoken to. They just don't work quite as well as the in-app experience that you would get on an iPad.
How does the iPad 2018 compare to the Google Chromebook now? I mean, what are we talking about the difference as far as cost, I should say?
The difference as far as cost can be as much as $130 per device.
That's a lot.
You know, there are student versions of Chromebooks that started around $200. And when you're talking about classrooms that are buying 20 and 30 of these at a time, that price is significant, considering the Chromebook has a keyboard and has, you know, kind of the mouse input system already there. And in some cases, more expensive versions that are similarly priced to the iPad have stylus support that you know, can also be used for those inputs. Whereas the iPad starts, its base model for this is $329. Which is a difficult ask for these mm-hmm. classrooms, considering you also have to buy at least a couple of keyboards.
We shall see what happens in the future, see what school districts are doing going forward. Sony PlayStation doesn't let users play along with gamers on the Xbox. And over the past few years, people have been getting more interested in doing just that. What's the deal?
It used to be that there was a technical limitation to PlayStation and Xbox games playing together. They were built on different hardware platforms, and so, you know, building that cross-compatibility was complicated. But over the last couple of years, we've seen the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4 release on Intel-based systems with NVIDIA graphics cards or with similar graphics systems. And so those technical limitations actually aren't there anymore. But the cross-compatibility has been a big challenge. When a game comes out that has big online gameplay, this week in particular, we saw Sea of Thieves and several other games, not to mention, you know, big globally popular games like Minecraft. You can play on the Xbox with people on a PC. You can play on the Xbox with people on a Nintendo Switch. But you cannot play on an Xbox with people on a PlayStation 4. And the reason, according to Microsoft, is that Sony refuses to play ball. And Sony has been very quiet on why they want this, they want this kind of limited ecosystem. The closest thing to an explanation that Sony has offered is that it's difficult from Sony's perspective to guarantee a certain level of experience when playing with people across these platforms. So you can have a lower quality experience with playing with someone on an Xbox because it's a quality that can't be guaranteed on Sony's end for their online services. But that's a difficult argument to maintain when you see, you know, someone on a Nintendo Switch and someone on an Xbox One playing together with no problem.
So is Sony hurting itself or is it protecting something?
Sony is definitely protecting something from my perspective. You know, Sony is the best selling of the game platforms right now. They have the largest possible audience. And there are people who buy PlayStation consoles in order to play games with their friends. You know, if you have access to an Xbox, it may not be your Xbox, maybe it's your brother or your father's Xbox, and you're playing those games, and you want to play with a friend, but then that friend only has a PlayStation, or most of your friends have a PlayStation, then you know, there's research that suggests you're more likely to go and get a PlayStation so that you can play all of these games with your friends.
Versus them going and getting an Xbox.
Right, and having that kind of cross-compatibility.
Right. So what changes do you think Sony will or could make to how PlayStation works with other consoles? What do you think they'll change?
I think the biggest thing that Sony can do here is to limit the kind of discussion around offering the best service and make it the responsibility of the game developers. If the people who make Rocket League have their own online service that each, you know, each of these consoles can play with, then that should just be allowed to happen. You know, it shouldn't be, Sony doesn't have to extend the PlayStation Network to function with these services. It can tie into these existing systems that are being used on the Xbox and on the Nintendo Switch. And so it's just those games that are allowing this kind of cross-compatibility instead of building a special system to try and communicate across these hardware devices. But if that's going to happen, it probably needs to happen this year. Otherwise, you know, more games are going to come out that are going to work with these other consoles, and Sony's experience is going to suffer as a result.
We shall see on that as well. You also wanted to talk about a new smartwatch from the Danish watchmaker. Is it Skagen or Skagen?
Skagen.
Okay.
It's the Skagen Falster watch. It's been a really interesting year for smartwatches, not so much in you know, new technology that has come up, but in all of these kind of higher-end watch brands releasing smartwatches that have their branding on it. So, you know, a special watch face or a special-looking band that is designed after, you know, those watches that you would normally get as kind of an expensive standard watch. And that kind of continued into this watch made by Skagen, which is a thin, very nice looking watch that runs the Android Wear platform, but doesn't have a lot of the added accessories for fitness tracking or anything like that. It's really just designed to be kind of a nice looking watch. And it's weird to look at that as a negative. It's weird to look at, you know, this smartwatch is just a watch.
But it's not a smartwatch if it's just a watch.
Right. You know, but it has, you know, kind of the basic feature set where it communicates with your phone and can grab notifications and do things like that. But it lacks the fitness tracking features and doesn't really do anything above and beyond what you would get for, you know, one of the less expensive smartwatches. You're really just kind of buying this because it has the Skagen brand on it, if that's a brand that appeals to you.
Mm-hmm. Have any others done something like this?
We've seen very similar things that have come out in the past year from Michael Kors and from several other, you know, kind of fashion brands that have released, you know, these very simple, but also, you know, very well branded watches, so that, you know, watch people can look at this watch and immediately recognize it as this particular brand. But it's still not a mechanical watch. It's still very much a you know, digital Android Wear watch.
Russell Holly, thank you so much. As always, appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.